Blog Talk Radio.
Actor Judge Reinhold discusses his new film Swing Vote and the possibility of a fourth Beverly Hills Cop film. Rich Moskal, the director of the Chicago Film Office, tells us all about his experiences accommodating the shooting of The Dark Knight. And we review two new DVDs from the Criterion Collection, Vampyr and High and Low. It's time to get your geek on because Movie Geeks United is on the air. United, we're on the air. Thanks for joining us. I hope everyone's having a great evening and are coming off of a great weekend. It's midweek, but
it is midweek, you know.
When we're taping this, the live taping is midweek. You know, you could be listening to this on a Saturday morning and not know what the hell I'm talking about. But
that's right. You could be
but,
hungover.
You know, whatever. This show has no expiration date. You can listen to it any day you want. So what's going on, Jerry? How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. You know, it's like you said, it's the midweek, you know, we're halfway there.
Yeah, movie, I feel like we provide an invaluable service, you know, in the midweek slump, we give you a little boost, and we get you through to Friday, and then Sunday, it's perfect, because Sunday you're all depressed, I gotta go back to work the next morning.
Oh, I always thought that was just
there we are.
You know, I always hated Sundays because it was either go back to school or go back to work, you know, and it's just an anxiety. But it's
exactly.
Universal.
Exactly.
All ages.
So there we are on Sunday nights for you like a warm binky. We are there.
Like a shot of tequila.
Yes. What a service we're providing. Welcome everyone in our chat room. We appreciate you joining us tonight. And thanks everyone for listening live tonight as well. If you're listening live, join everyone in the chat room. It's a great time in there. Everybody's chatting back and forth about movies and a lot of other stuff that makes me blush. But it's great fun. So I really recommend that you guys do that. This Sunday, before we get to the show, which is exciting, exciting show tonight, I want to tell you guys about Sunday. Sunday we're welcoming Randall Miller, who is the director of the films Nobel Sun and Bottle Shock, and both of those movies are getting a lot of buzz. Both star Alan Rickman and Bill Pullman, and a great ensemble cast. We've talked about this film last show when we interviewed one of the co-stars, Hal B. Klein.
Mm-hmm.
He'll be joining us, and we will also be speaking to the author of a really cool book called Setting Up Your Shots. It's in its second edition now. And it's a very long book because it basically shows you storyboards of all these different shots, types of shots in films, you know, whether it be, you know, any kind of dolly moves or any kind of jump cuts or it's a very neat book. So he's going to join us and he's going to discuss some of that with us. And then, inspired by that, the three movie geeks are going to join together and we're going to review our favorite shots and sequences from movies. That'll be great fun. And we really hope everybody calls in and shares your favorite shot or sequence from a movie. I mean, there's obviously so many of them, and just all of them happen to be in Brian De Palma's films. But
no, actually,
you know.
Only one really I can think of one so far, or two.
I'm kidding.
No, we could do a whole like show just about that, though. I mean, we really could.
I think so. So let's get right to it. This was a pre-recorded interview we did a couple of weeks ago with Judge Reinhold. We wanted to wait until the eve of his new movie Swing Vote to premiere it. It is one of the most comfortable, conversational, funny interviews we've ever conducted. He is a wonderful guest, and such a generosity of spirit he has, and you can hear it in this interview. His new film, like I said, Swing Vote, opens this Friday. And let's get right to it.
Let's
I know you're
it.
Excited about hearing it.
Yes, I am. I am excited.
Let's do it. Judge Reinhold, everybody. Our next guest has given us a tremendous amount of joy and entertainment over a career that spans nearly 30 years. He's delivered.
No, you're right.
He's delivered unforgettable performances in a breathtaking roster of timeless films like Stripes, Gremlins, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Ruthless People, Into the West, and both the Santa Claus and Beverly Hills Cop trilogies. He was nominated for an Emmy for his guest role in the hit comedy Seinfeld, and his next film finds him in the company of Kevin Costner, Dennis Hopper, and Kelsey Grammer as he co-stars in the political comedy Swing Vote, opening August 1st. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome this fantastic actor to Movie Geeks United, Mr. Judge Reinhold. Mr. Reinhold,
wow.
Hello.
Thank you.
Other than that first sentence, it sounded pretty good.
Oh no, it was all good. No. It's true. I don't. They say age is mind over matter. If you don't mind, it don't matter. You know.
Right.
And I'm good. It is a little disconcerting when people say I grew up with your movies because I guess I was kind of. It's not like I was thinking like Jim Morrison. I'll never make it to 30, but. It's just an odd thing to suddenly, especially if, you know, with the consideration of Obama possibly being president, the idea of a president actually younger than you, that's frightening. You know, I don't know if I can vote for the guy just for that, you know.
That's when you really start feeling your age, yeah.
Oh, man, that's freaky. Yeah,
but you do have these credits to your name that appeal
yeah.
to all different generations, from Fast Times to the Beethoven and Santa Claus movies, and of course Beverly Hills
yeah.
Cop. Do you find that new generations are discovering these films?
I do. I'm actually getting work from some of these young directors that grew up with these movies. So it's professionally, it's pretty cool. There's a little cachet involved with. Them growing up watching Beverly Hills Cop and Fast Times and stuff. As a matter of fact, the director, Joshua Michael Stern, who co-wrote and directed the Swing Vote that I'm doing with Kevin Costner, was one of those people who said, oh, I can't read Judge Reinhold, just give him the role. So that was sweet.
That's fantastic. Now take me back to the beginning. I want to know who your influences
yeah.
were when you wanted to become an actor.
Okay. The first time I really realized that what an actor was, I guess I was watching Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated by his westerns and just his whole persona.
Yeah.
And then I remember skipping school and sneaking into Catch 22 at the age of 12 years old, and that totally blew my mind. It
wow.
just blew my mind. And Alan Arkin became my acting mentor from afar. And as great, great fortune would have it, he ended up oddly on the set of Santa Claus 3, and we became friends. We both live in Santa Fe. And the rest is history. It took me days to call him up. I'd get the nerve to call him up on the phone, you know, and I finally did, and I left a message, a very awkward message, and then I went into town and came back, and there the light was blinking. I thought, oh, it's Arkin, oh my God. And he says, Judge, oh wow, what a pleasure to hear from you. People in our business don't do that. Let's have lunch, take a walk. Shoot coyotes, whatever it is you want to do, I would
oh,
be happy to do. And so, yeah, so it's so exciting to be personal friends with.
Oh, that's fantastic.
You know, he was really my hero, you know?
Oh, yeah, so. Oh, yeah, and what a hero to have. I mean, he's phenomenal. Did you start in theater?
I think I read where you started... Yeah.
You did something with Burt Reynolds at his theater company, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, but it's I was a sophomore in high school, got on the stage, and it felt like home. I just felt completely comfortable up there, and my life suddenly became very simple and uncomplicated. And so I was
I was a goner from then on. I didn't think about making a living or anything. I just had to be on the stage and telling a story.
This is what I'm curious about, because obviously I want to ask you about how the industry, the business, has changed for you in the past 30 years. But in terms of your need to act, what it fulfills in you, what is that, and has that changed over the course of your career?
That's a good question. It used to be just the thrill of being an actor and getting a laugh, and it's luckily evolved and refined into the desire to tell a good story. And so it's evolved into a producing a need to tell some stories that reflect things that I just the way I see the world, and a need to try to do things well after almost 30 years of watching people make unnecessary and careless mistakes. I'm certainly going to make my own mistakes, but I'd rather make my own than just watch the same ones be made over and over again. So to answer your question, it went from just kind of wanting to get the attention to really wanting to turn out some great stories, you know.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you a little later about your producing work, because I think it's very important when I've read what you have to say about some of these projects. I did read a quote from you, and it speaks to what you've just said, I think. You said, "I want to do things of significance, things that will inspire people to know how good life can be. It's very easy to make a movie that confirms the worst in us." How does Swing Vote fit that bill for you?
Ah, that's a great segue, because it's the story of the whole country being deadlocked. The presidential election comes down to one man's vote. And Kevin plays just a barely functioning alcoholic and a father who is really taken care of by his 11-year-old daughter. And he gets to work. She makes sure she gets him to work. At it's in a little town that the main industry is boxing eggs. And I play his friend Walter, complete with mullet and handlebar mustache. Anyway, he's got to get his act together to figure out who's going to be president. And, of course, the whole world descends on the little town of Texaco, New Mexico, which actually exists. We just had to move it to Albuquerque for logistical sake. It's really close to the border of Mexico and New Mexico. The story is very Capra-esque.
Yes.
Extremely Capra-esque. I feel like I have the Ward Bond role, you know. It's the most Capra-esque movie I've come across, really. And to the point where I thought, we all kind of looked at each other and thought, this is the closest we're going to get to work with Frank Capra, because the story is something that he could so easily have done. And because it's about one guy and the whole world, with the whole, literally the whole world on his shoulders. And per your question, when I first read the script, I thought, oh, this is going to end up with this kind of nihilistic look at how messed up everything is, and how corrupt politics has become, and how lost we all are. But surprisingly, with kind of a Capra-esque hopefulness, it ends with everybody having a crisis of conscience. And they look at themselves and realize that it's like Obama says, you know, what does Obama say? The future is you or something, or we're the change that we're looking for. And so actually it is kind of, not to get political, but it is kind of like that. Everybody looks at themselves except for the two handlers of the two, Kelsey Grammer plays the Republican president, flies in on Air Force One and gets Richard Petty to pick Kevin up from his trailer to drive him to Air Force One to try to get him on the Republican side. And Dennis Hopper gets Willie Nelson to sing for Kevin to get him over on the Democratic side. Everybody ends up looking at themselves except for the handlers, the Karl Rove character, the Machiavellian characters. In this case, it's played by Stanley Tucci, who is such a brilliant actor. And Nathan Lane plays the handler on the Democratic side. Not Carvel. It's not really Carvel. I don't know who really... I don't know who the template is for that, but those guys are the nefarious ones. If there are villains, it's the spinners, because even the candidates take a hard look at themselves. So that's a really long-winded answer, but it does have. Sorry, but it's rare. One thing that really made me fall in love with the script was it ends positively. It ends with hope, but in a practical way, not in a Hollywood, you know, perfunctory way. Well, we'll just throw in this little fairy tale hopefulness.
Yeah.
You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Well, it couldn't be more timely, obviously.
And
we're talking about the presidential election process, and that seems like such a subject matter that's ripe for satire. Is it almost difficult to satirize because we see it? I mean, it's obvious how extreme the process is and how far people go in this process. And
yeah, that's what's so great is that it is grounded in reality, but it's hysterically funny. When you crack the crew up, you know you got something. You know, that's been my experience. When the crew's laughing, then you know you got something good because they don't have to laugh. Yeah,
right.
So I think it's satire at its best, really, because it's not too far-fetched. It doesn't get too broad, and it's based in very significant, timely the themes. You know?
Yeah. What do you hope that people take away from it?
Personal responsibility and their need to vote.
Mm.
Kevin's character represents American lethargy, American indulgence, and hey, I love my country. I don't mean to sound like, you know, one of those people. We just have to grow up a little bit, you know, and get involved in our, and gosh, the least we can do is vote or don't complain, you know?
Right.
So it's about personal responsibility. It's on every level. That's what I like about it. The President of the United States has to look and see, hey, wait a minute, this guy's spinning me out of control. All the things that I once believe in, I'm compromising for one man's vote.
Right.
And Dennis Hopper, the Democratic candidate on the other side, is faced with that too. Everybody has a crisis of conscience, and everybody takes a closer look at the choices that they've been making and how responsible they are. We're all responsible. Everybody, you know, everybody's, then I'll shut up about this, but...
this is fantastic. I think this is terrific.
Everybody's really tied to the choices we make. Anybody who tells you that's not true is just, they're not looking squarely at their life.
Yeah.
Everybody is tied to the decisions that we make, positive or negative. They're going to affect people around you.
Yeah.
And that's really the message. You know, how much responsibility we take and how involved we get in what's going on it's going to determine, if not on a grand scale, then certainly our sphere of influence and our own communities.
Yeah.
So his character goes from lethargy, apathy, the drunkenness is supposed to represent just total indulgence, to pulling himself up and saying, wow, I better try to do the right thing. Yeah.
I think it's an important message to project out there, you know, and obviously first and foremost, this is a comedy.
That's great. You're right on target because you can, what was it I saw recently? It was so, it was so preachy.
Yeah.
And proselytizing, and then I thought about our movie, and I thought the reason I love our movie is because it doesn't proselytize, but it teaches on a level that is purely entertaining, and that it's harder work to do that, but that's really That's what great satire is. It's got to be entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. And tell me about your director. You mentioned him earlier for this
Joshua
film.
Michael Stern. Yeah, yeah. He's an exciting writer director, and Kevin gave him a shot. And,
I asked because this is a man that he's already lined up his next project, and it's King Lear with Anthony Hopkins. So he seems very ambitious, this filmmaker.
That's what he's doing, King Lear?
Yes, he's doing Lear with Hopkins, is what I've
learned
in the trades, yeah.
Wow, good for him. I'm surprised, too. That's great.
Yeah, you could feel their contribution missing from.
Well, they were still alive. Don was still alive, but Sherry and the guys, really the guys that were running Paramount at the time, after Days of Thunder, rather than just chastise him.
Okay, we've got difficulties. Jerry, are you with us?
Yes, I am. What happened? What?
These files aren't right. That I downloaded for the interview.
Oh no! All right. Well, wait. What's the problem? What they're they didn't upload, or the rest didn't upload, or
well, the second part of it didn't upload.
Oh. Well, what about the all right? Okay. What do you want to do? What do you want to do? Besides,
what do you
want to
do?
Besides charades.
I'm not really sure what to do now. For those of you joining us on the live feed, we have some problems. Not all of our second part of our Judge Reinhold interview downloaded. So I'll play this last third for you. Essentially, we finished talking about Swing Vote, and we went on to the rumors of a fourth Beverly Hills Cop. And Mr. Reinhold had some definite words to say about what he wants out of it and what he wants from the character that he plays in Beverly Hills Cop 4. And then he started speaking about how Beverly Hills Cop 3 strays from the feeling of the first two and how he disagreed with that judgment. And then he started speaking of how much he missed the producing team of Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer from that third production.
Okay.
So I'm going to play this third part. Let me take this phone call real quick. How much he missed the producing team of Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer. Okay, that's just myself talking back to me on that line. What's going on? Is this show possessed tonight or what?
I think it's possessed. I think we it's just on Wednesday nights. It's
been terrible. Like
yeah,
the files haven't uploaded. Sunday's always a... What we're going to have to do is I'm going to have to program this again for tomorrow, a show tomorrow, and replay this interview.
Okay.
And record and replay our next guest too.
Right.
Yep. So that's what I'm going to have to do. Sorry, guys, on the live feed. Aaron, what you up to?
Hey, what's up, guys?
Hey, how
what's
you
up?
Doing?
All right, I'm doing good. Good thing my show is on Tuesdays and Thursdays, eh?
Yeah. Why is that?
Because apparently Wednesdays isn't the best day to be on.
Oh, yeah. It hasn't been. We've had the most terrible luck for the past,
I know. It's just not something. It's just on Wednesday nights. Any kind of technological thing just does not go right.
Has anyone found out, is it Blog Talk Radio across the board on Wednesday, or is it... Are we only the special ones that get singled out?
I don't know, man.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed, though, because this is a great interview.
It sounded great. I mean, Judge Reinhold, underrated comic actor. And I'm totally sincere. Judge Reinhold,
yeah,
back in the day, was underrated comic actor. Obviously, Fast Times and Stripes, but Ruthless People. And no one remembers... Big always gets talked about, but the glut of those switching body movies, Judge Reinhold made the other good one, which was Vice Versa, with Fred Savage, which was a really funny film.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Let me test this. Hang on. Let me see what's going on. Talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, well, I'm just kind of, you got to forgive me, I'm just kind of like flabbergasted that this has happened once again.
Yeah.
I really thought this would go very smoothly because you uploaded it a while ago. And,
several days ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Okay,
well,
we're gonna go ahead and play this third part though, and then,
okay.
And then Aaron, we're gonna bring you on at your segment at the end of the show.
Looking forward to it.
And in about 15 minutes, we're going to welcome a special guest to our show. Let's see, an hour and 4 minutes. Okay, we got it. Let me take this caller. It's 312. 312, go ahead.
Hey, it's Rich Moskal from the Chicago Film Office.
Hey.
Oh, hi, Mr. Moskal.
Hey, I was listening to the show. Heard you had some difficulties. I figured if you wanted to start early, that's cool. Otherwise, I can call you back in a little bit.
Let's do that.
Let's do it.
Let's go ahead and do that. I'm very excited about speaking with you. So let's let me read your intro real quick.
Sure.
This is as smooth a segue as we can get. You've got Christian Bale, Heath Ledger, and a host of some of our greatest actors in The Dark Knight, but the true star of the film just may be the city in which it was shot. I'm speaking, of course, of Chicago, which has quickly become one of the hot spots in the country for film production. To speak to this cinematic phenomenon is Richard Moskal, the director of the Chicago Film Office, and we are thrilled to welcome him to the show tonight to tell us all about the shooting of The Dark Knight and all the exciting film production happenings in his city. Mr. Moskal, thank you for calling in early.
You're welcome.
You're
thank
insane.
You.
Thank you
for saving us.
I'm happy to be here. I was taking a, ripping a page from the Batman playbook.
You saw the signal up to the sky, save us. And,
yeah, I mean...
I'm fascinated by...
Thank you, Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by what you do, and I'm wondering, what is the career trajectory? How did you find yourself in the position that you hold now?
Not very directly, that's for sure. I started out... I had a more recently before... working in this position with the city of Chicago, a background in film production, and worked as a location manager on features that mostly were shot here in Chicago. And then prior to that, I had worked briefly over at the Illinois Film Office, which is a partner organization with state government, both offices working to attract film production here. And then prior to that, I was taking pictures at a racetrack at the finish line in the Winter Circle for thoroughbreds and harness racing. So I don't know how, necessarily direct of a path that was, but, I started actually getting interested in film here in Chicago shortly after the Blues Brothers was made here.
Yeah,
And that, without question, put Chicago very much on, at least on Hollywood's map as a place to shoot. And there was a buzz in the air around Chicago, like, hey, they're making movies in town. And literally on a whim, I called. I was in school at the time, and I was sort of paying my way through college, and I called about getting an internship with the Illinois Film Office, and they do a lot of location scouting for movies and for television productions and the like, and just happened to be at the right place at the right time and started scouting locations for movies, and that sort of led to location management and then to... And then to government.
So when you present your city for consideration, what are Chicago's selling points? What makes it unique and special for film production companies?
Several, actually. And fortunately, there are several, because these days you really can't rely on just one trick, frankly, to attract the industry. So much of it is a balancing act between finances and directors' interests and studios' relationship. But Chicago truly does have a very distinguished, undeniable look, very cinematic in terms of its architecture and its skyline, and some very unique attributes as well, places that The Dark Knight used to great extent. In fact, places like Lower Wacker Drive and the Chicago River and sort of a subterranean network of roadways and alleyways that give the city a lot of dimension. I can't remember the statistic, but Chicago is home to more bridges than any other city in the world, but it has to be a particular type of bridge, otherwise, you know, I'm sort of misquoting the stat. But frankly, there's a lot of moving parts and pieces to the city of Chicago that cinematically work very well. If you're familiar with the elevated transit system in Chicago, the L, it's literally a train that snakes its way through downtown Chicago and out into the neighborhoods, and it's a great place to stage fight sequences and chase sequences. And Risky Business some years ago staged, you know, a lovemaking scene on a subway train, and it's just got a lot of
attraction. Oh yes, I remember
that. You know? So that I think the look of Chicago is something that directors and production designers and cinematographers like. But Chicago over the years has been growing a rather expert and deep talent pool of crew and actors who have been working in the industry for many years, and obviously having that indigenous infrastructure, as well as vendors who supply all the goods necessary, the equipment necessary for the business, means that producers coming from Hollywood don't have to bring all of those people and all of that equipment with them, which obviously lowers their overhead. And then we like to think that we make it easy for people to shoot here, particularly when you start talking about pulling off some extraordinary, spectacular stunt work like in The Dark Knight. It took a great deal of city cooperation to make that possible. And then all of that combined made much more affordable by the fact that the state of Illinois is now offering a tax incentive, a 20% tax credit on all local expenditures to the film industry, which is a great deal, but sadly it pales in comparison to some of the other incentives out there. But I think the production value that Chicago and Illinois offers sort of trumps what can be the cheaper deal around. And I think studios and directors and producers have come to know that shooting in Chicago is a place that gives you a lot for the money. And that's what it's been our call and trade. It's been a success in the past few years.
Absolutely. And for me, Chicago really was one of the key stars of the film The Dark Knight. I mean, it was striking just from the opening frames. It was striking. And I want to talk to you about that shoot, but could you give me a sense of how having a robust film production scene means to a place like Chicago?
You know, financially, it can mean quite a bit. The Dark Knight alone spent close to $36 million in terms of hiring local crew and using local businesses and vendors and things like that. Last year, in fact, Dark Knight was really just one of like 80 different film and television projects they shot over the course of the year here in Chicago, and all of that combined added up to $155 million. So there's a true economic impact that the film industry and the television industry bring to the city, which of course is great in a time when the economy is not so hot. It also contributes to the tax base, which sort of lowers the tax burden for all of us taxpayers here. But then there's that less tangible, softer benefit of what does it mean in terms of exposing the city to audiences around the world. And on the back of an international blockbuster, it can't help but increase people's awareness and familiarity with the city of Chicago, whether it's them saying, hey, that looks cool, or I didn't even know Chicago had such a huge downtown area, or maybe it'd be interesting to go there and see where they shot the film. You never know really how it's going to impact people, but clearly films have proven to be a trigger for interest in tourism, interest in people conducting business, or just Chicago right now is vying for the Olympics in 2016, so it's vying for a place on the world stage, and not that The Dark Knight is going to pave the way for that, but it certainly isn't going to hurt in terms of people recognizing that big things happen in Chicago, and part of the culture is film, as well as a combined, interesting, diverse package of cultural attributes in terms of music and theater and dance and things like that. So I think having a vibrant film industry here can be a bit of a calling card to a much bigger picture of Chicago, and that's something that I think is part of the reason why the city worked so hard to try to accommodate it and keep it coming back.
In terms of the community and the people there, how do they react to the production? Because you hear all kinds of different stories. You hear people that are terribly annoyed, and in other places, it's old hat. You know, it's just like nothing else is, you know, nothing's going on really when there's a production on their street. How is it impacting the community? Are they excited about it largely? Or
I would say overall, for the most part, people are still excited about it. It's not as novel as it was back in the day of the Blues Brothers when it was a very new phenomenon in terms of even a movie just being made in Chicago was almost unheard of back then. So these days, people are far more accustomed to it, and no doubt about it, some people aren't as enamored as others, and I think it's almost human nature that when something shows up on your doorstep or right out in front of your office building that isn't normally there, it has a tendency to put people off and make them feel like, hey, what's this all about, you know? But I think that is, frankly, a big part of what our job is, at least my job anyway, is to talk about the industry in terms of what makes sense, in terms of why it happens here and what's the benefits, but also laying a lot of the groundwork for giving people the notification so that when they do come upon it, at least they've had some sort of notice. Nobody likes to, myself included, you know, nobody likes surprises. And I think the human
right
response to what the hell is this all about, you know?
Yeah.
Nobody told, who gave him permission to do this? Now, with The Dark Knight, there was always, a very convincing, as soon as people heard it was a Batman movie, it triggered a lot of interest and a lot of enthusiasm. Films that don't have that brand or that name recognition have a tougher time of convincing people that, oh, this is going to be interesting, even though they may just be as big and as important or with, you know, big stars. It just doesn't have the same cachet as when you say to somebody, oh, it's a Batman movie, then everybody's into it, you know. But yeah, without question, the biggest challenge we face is trying to carve out room for, you know, this sort of epic storytelling with all kinds of equipment and lights and vehicles and hundreds of crew, and find a comfortable place for them to work within the confines of the real world. And the real world can be busy and crowded, and everybody's rushing to get someplace. So you plop that down in the middle of the city, and trying to avoid pissing everybody off, frankly, can be a bit of a challenge. So we did something relatively different for The Dark Knight in that in order to almost set the stage for what was going to be, without question, an impactful production shooting in Chicago for a long period of time, Warner Brothers and Chris Nolan and Christian Bale actually agreed to do a press conference with the mayor announcing the fact that the film was going to be shot here. It was going to be great for the city. It was going to be interesting. It was going to be fun, but it was also going to screw things up. And at least giving people that sort of fair warning and putting in the context of what it means of benefit to the city, I think, at least sort of, and I was very grateful that Warner Brothers and the filmmakers themselves were open to doing that, because
that's unheard of.
Well, you know, we usually try to keep it a little bit under wraps.
Yeah.
Not that we're trying to be secretive or fly under the radar, but the last thing you want to do is keep telling people, oh, they're going to be filming a movie right here at this time.
When you're trying to get to work or something.
You're going to draw bigger crowds and you know, particularly, you know, the fans of the Batman franchise, they'll be coming out of the woodwork, frankly, in order to see the film or to see a film being made. So it was a bit of a gamble, but I think it ultimately paid off, and it was something that I think gave residents of the city a sense that their concerns were being respected and looked out for, and I think it also gave filmmakers an opportunity to help explain themselves in terms of what they were doing here.
Right.
Go ahead, Jerry.
I have a question just regarding how do you handle a massive period piece like the Michael Mann's Public Enemies, how, what's the, because you have to obviously, you know, you have to make, you have to get, recreate a certain time period. How do you go about doing that? I would imagine that's going to be very difficult.
In some ways, you know, the Public Enemy shoot was tougher than, well, I shouldn't say that because it's only because it's been, it's newer, it's fresher in my mind, it's
right.
complicated. But the period nature of it meant that their footprint was so much larger in many ways in terms of everything that they saw had to be transformed or redressed or taken away to look of the period, 1920s, 1930s,
right.
which meant taking down everything from traffic signals to streetlights to all the street furniture, obviously redressing storefronts and in some cases rebuilding facades over the course of a
right.
block. The scene, and if you know the John Dillinger history at all for of what Public Enemies is all about, he's not giving anything away. He's gunned down.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a spoiler.
He's gunned down out in front of the Biograph Theater, which
yeah.
is a
mm-hmm.
movie theater in Chicago. Well, that was obviously a big scene for the film and, in fact, took a good 10 days to shoot and probably about 2 weeks to prep in terms of redressing a good two blocks of a rather busy commercial strip, Lincoln Avenue, in the Lincoln Park neighborhood. And right down the center of the street, one of the things that they did, which was very beautiful in terms of making it look period, but frankly was always a sort of a clumsy impact on the street, is that they would roll out this almost like a big carpet or linoleum, this foam cobblestone
mm-hmm.
that would just transform the street almost immediately into looking like an old-fashioned street, and then down the center of the street would roll this cobblestone and they would make it look like a streetcar was going down it. Of course, that meant diverting all kinds of traffic and that type of stuff. So it did take, in some ways, a little bit more prep and doing. There wasn't the number of stunts and pyrotechnics and aerial work with helicopters that
mm-hmm.
Dark Knight called for, but certainly Public Enemies had its own brand of its own personality of disruption, if you want to call it that. And once again, it did have something going for it that people could almost immediately identify. They knew the story. John Dillinger is a, you know, well-known character in Chicago culture and history,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that Johnny Depp was playing him bought a lot of cooperation, if nothing else, a lot of curiosity. So people were, and not only that, it's cool to look at. You see, it's real old Hollywood stuff to see an entire two-block stretch transformed into something very authentically period, and people loved it, frankly.
Because you don't get to see that much anymore, because they usually, like something for like Acid Dust, Robert Towns' Acid Dust, they shot old Los Angeles in South Africa.
Right.
So I think it's
yeah.
really awesome that, you know, they're using Chicago, using a real city, a real American city, to film this.
Well, you know, I think there was something that Michael Mann wanted. They looked at movie theaters, not necessarily all over the world, but certainly all over the Midwest, to try to find some place that might be a little bit easier to work, but kind of went for the real thing because it meant something to the films
right.
that they were using the real thing. And I think that was also true. In fact, I know it's true of Chris Nolan, in that unlike previous versions of the Batman franchise, which were very manufactured in terms
mm-hmm.
of sets built and soundstage,
mm-hmm.
huge soundstage pieces and backlot pieces, he wanted something very gritty and very authentic and very real, and shooting in a real city, not that people immediately associated Chicago with Gotham. I think New York probably would have claim on that more so than us. I think Chris's recollection, Chris actually grew up in Chicago, or at least he did up until he was about 14 years old.
Right.
And his remembrances of places like Lower Wacker Drive and the L and the financial district of LaSalle Street fit his vision of what he thought Gotham should be all about. And using real locations, I think, added a, well, what am I he's the filmmaker. He knows better than I do. But I would certainly
say it's a real city.
You know, it's a real city.
And that's what these last two films work so well, because no wonder some of the New York critics didn't like it. They felt, oh, my God, it's Chicago. It's not New York. Oh, my God.
I was picking up on that, too. It's like, hey, you know what? In fact, when Batman, because Batman Begins shot in Chicago back in 2004.
Right.
For about 3 weeks. And, in fact, it was a bit of a test run. Chris lobbied to have, he wanted to shoot just a few days in Chicago. And as directors are wont to do, you know, he sort of used that as his foot in the door and then sort of leveraged that into 2 or 3 weeks. And yet it was 2 or 3 weeks, not a long period of time, but some of the more aggressive and ambitious stunt sequences of the film. And things went extraordinarily well. I mean, it really went well. It was difficult, but I think he was very satisfied. Warner Brothers, I think, despite their initial concerns, was very satisfied. In fact, it only helped us that all the big executives from Warner Brothers happened to be in town one of the days when they were doing some of the hairiest stunt work on Batman Begins, and they were thrilled to see how well things were going. And then, of course, it looked great, and the film was a success. So it set the stage for them to be able to come back and do something much larger on this version. Oh, now I lost my train of thought. What the heck were we talking about?
But he shot like two for. Did he shoot for 2 months this time on The Dark Knight in Chicago?
In Chicago, it was actually closer to 3.5.
Oh, wow.
They started in April and shot for a little bit over a week, just that opening sequence of the bank robbery. And then they went back to London, did some stage work, and then came back to Chicago and shot pretty much all of June, July, August, into the first week of September.
Now, how much time did you have actually on the set of that?
Myself?
Yes.
I was there quite a bit. In fact, I was there a lot, and in part because it was just fun, but also because it truly was challenging. I mean, there was unprecedented stunt work that we were doing that I felt, not that I was going to, just by being there, make it go smoother, but it certainly meant that having sort of like an all-hands-on-deck approach to making things run as smooth as possible and at least doing the best we could to sort of troubleshoot the problems before they became big problems. And obviously looking out for both the city as well as the filmmakers, it required being there quite a bit. So it was a good problem to have, although I was happy to see it all sort of end smoothly. But being there meant seeing some of the stuff that I knew for a fact we had never done before in terms of flipping trucks end over end and imploding buildings of that size.
Were those the most memorable moments, the kind of the juiciest moments for you? Observing?
For me, they were, yeah. The truck, without question, although, you know, just to create a proper safety zone, everybody except firemen and some camera operators who needed to be close by, everybody else was pushed back to a good block and a half from the actual stunt, which was a good thing. Everybody kind of craning their neck. There were some people working late night in their office buildings that had a bird's eye view. They probably got the best view of all, but for the rest of us who were sort of down in the street, so seeing it in the film, actually, it was a much closer perspective, but still, even from a distance, it was pretty damn spectacular.
I bet.
The hospital implosion. We've done big explosions here, but nothing quite of that scale before. And it was made that much more interesting in terms of the process, because they had contracted with the rock stars of the demolition world, the Wazzo family, who have a company that they implode buildings all over the world. That's their call to fame. You know, they dropped, I think it's the Flamingo Hotel, one of the big older hotels in Nevada.
Yeah.
And they've dropped some buildings here in Chicago in the past, but that's what they specialize in. And as much as that was augmented with a whole lot of movie pyrotechnics in terms of fireballs and things like that, it was treated very much like a regular demolition, building demolition in terms of dealing with utilities and power lines and a whole slew of government agencies that we, generally speaking, don't deal with on a regular basis, but had to be brought in just to make sure we didn't really screw something up really bad.
What was that building in actuality?
You know, Chicago has a history in terms of candy manufacturing, and Brock's Candy was one of the big manufacturers all through the 50s and 60s. And this was a closed administration building, which was part of the big Brock's Candy factory, which has been empty for a number of years.
Okay.
The guy who owned it was no longer owned by a candy company, but the guy who owned it, I think, was happy that Warner Brothers came along because it meant that he didn't have to tear down the building himself.
I bet, yeah. In terms of scripts, do you have, when you read a script, do you look for it to shine a positive light on the city? I mean, do you turn down opportunities because perhaps it's not, it doesn't shed the best light on the city in terms of the story itself?
I can't say I totally block out issues that may not be in the city, portray the city in the best light, but in all honesty, we really can't, we can't weigh in on whether it's good for the city or bad for the city based on content. If we were to do that, I think we would probably alienate a good number of the studios, and if we started picking and choosing what we're willing to work with. I mean, the guy who made My Best Friend's Wedding, which was a sweet love story, picture postcard, beauty shots of the city, while he was here, so much like Chicago, ended up writing a script while he was here in Chicago making My Best Friend's Wedding about a serial killer that was stalking Lower Wacker Drive with a crossbow and picking off prostitutes. So you can't necessarily say, hey, you know, yeah, we like your My Best Friend's Wedding script, but this, you know, this crossbow killer thing is not. And it was a trippy script too. I mean, it was sort of done in a sort of a musical song and dance version. Unconditional Love was the name of the movie. It didn't get a whole lot of distribution, but nevertheless, we can't necessarily, in the interest of entertaining the industry, I think we would have a tough time in saying, yeah, we like this one, but we don't like that one.
Now,
the, you know, certain city agencies like the police department will read scripts and either officially grant, and this is common, I think, in throughout police departments across the country, well, they'll either truly depict themselves or be depicted in other ways, like the Metro Police or just the police department, and I think it's their way of being able to essentially say we don't necessarily agree with their depiction, but my feeling is, and I think generally speaking, the city of Chicago's official stance on it is, we're here to facilitate production regardless of the content. Now, if we ever got into the situation of something that was, you know, really, really tough material, I think I'm not sure how we would deal with it. Fortunately, we haven't had to have that problem yet.
Sure. You mentioned that The Unconditional Love was a musical treatment, and it made me think. I think it's so ironic that the film Chicago, it wasn't shot in your city, was it?
No, it wasn't. It was it was the straw that broke the camel's back, frankly. It was shot in Toronto. There was a digital effects crew that came in for about a day and a half and got some plate shots of some period locations in the L. But with that exception, it was all shot up in Toronto. And it was right about that time that Illinois was considering, despite being lobbied by the local film industry for some years, it was about that time that Illinois was really seriously starting to consider offering an incentive. Yeah. And the fact that Chicago was not shot in Chicago was probably the best poster child for that issue in terms of saying this is the industry that we're losing. Because up until that point, nobody was really thinking about the movies that weren't shot here because they didn't know that they were even considering or could have considered to shoot in Chicago, but the film Chicago Not Shooting Here truly did convince legislators and the general public, actually, that there was a loss that they weren't even recognizing, and that was the best thing that could have happened to us, frankly.
Yeah. So what that kind of exciting.
No, I would
project...
argue that movie would have been as great as it was in terms of, you know, Academy Awards and blockbuster success. It would have been a lot better had it been shot in Chicago. But that.
I think so too. It seems almost kind of immoral. Like it's cheating the audience somehow when you have a movie set in Chicago that is not shot in Chicago.
Well, you know, we win and lose by that game ourselves. You know, there's been movies that were probably breaking somebody's heart somewhere else, you know, whether it be movies that were written for New York and shot in Chicago or written for, you know, Cleveland. Or, I mean, we've been the beneficiary of that same irony. So I can't say that, you know, we haven't, isn't that cool? But I think, and I know what I was thinking. You know, this was something I mentioned a while ago, but when Batman Begins for shot in Chicago, I did get a call from my counterpart in New York saying, hey, we're Gotham City, man. You guys can't have this Batman movie. So, you know, like I said, we do sort of, we live and die by the same sword.
They have Metropolis. Sword. What are they complaining about?
Right. regarding another superhero thing, Spider-Man 2, and the Spider-Man series is all set in New York and in part has been shot in New York, although I think the last one they actually shot a big portion of it in Cleveland, believe it or not. But for the scene where Spider-Man is fighting Doc Ock on top of a moving L train.
Yes.
It was scripted, obviously, for New York, but the L in New York does not run through Manhattan. It runs through the boroughs, or at least not through the heart of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I don't know my Manhattan geography as well as I should, perhaps, but I know it doesn't cut through skyscraper canyons, and Sam Raimi wanted this scene to happen through just that type of geography, these skyscraper canyons. So they shot all of that sequence with the exception of the characters here in Chicago so they could get that effect, and we're here for about a week and a half shooting with this rig ironically called the Spider Cam, which had nothing to do with the film except that that's
right.
what the device is called, and it's a camera that sort of tracks at high elevations between two huge construction cranes, so they could literally track with a moving L train and then digitally insert the characters fighting. So Chicago actually served as a decent backdrop.
It really did, yeah. And it's a great time to be in the comic book movie business too. So it's good that you,
yeah, it is.
Absolutely. What kind of exciting future projects are on the horizon in Chicago?
Well, we did just finish up, the Public Enemies project. There's a new television series that just started shooting this week, as a matter of fact, called The Beast, which is a series for A&E that stars Patrick Swayze.
Patrick Swayze, right.
Yeah. And I think with what was happening with the debate over whether or not there was going to be a Screen Actors Guild strike, despite the fact that it's looking very much like there's not going to be, it has sort of slowed things down. There was a rush to production with a host of things that were shooting in Chicago earlier in the year. But we've got a lot of movies. You know, Wanted is still out in theaters, which was shot in part in Chicago. Diminished Capacity was shot in part in Chicago. I don't know if you guys...
I did see that.
And there's a film called The Promotion, which stars John C. Reilly, which was directed by a Chicagoan, Steve Conrad. Steve Conrad really being much more, well, I shouldn't say accomplished, because he was a good director as well, but has written any number of scripts, including The Weatherman, which was shot in Chicago.
Yes,
this was
his
directorial debut, and he chose as a Chicagoan. You know, we've been our biggest sales force, frankly, has been Chicagoans in a position of clout who, whether they still live here or have migrated west or east are now insisting upon coming back and shooting here. People like Vince Vaughn, the guys who made the Barbershop films and Soul Food, George Tillman and Bob Teitel, Bonnie Hunt, Harold Ramis. These have become our sort of local heroes sales force, and they're the ones who are actually, before we even get a chance to pitch something, are making a case to say, hey, I want to shoot in Chicago, and we're appreciative for it.
Speaking of Chicago filmmaking heroes, and this is the last question, I'll let you off the hook. John Hughes.
Yeah.
Have you met him? Because he seems to be in hiding.
Yeah, I have met him. I've met him several times over the years. Actually worked for him on one picture that he did here, Miracle on 34th Street. He produced it and wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John has, and I'm sure he doesn't need to work these mm-hmm. days from a financial standpoint. He stopped directing some years back. He's still very active writing. It seems that whenever word of him getting back into it starts to bubble up and things get close to happening, something goes awry and the picture falls apart or he drops out of it. Mm. You know, I don't know him well enough, but he certainly has a reputation of being somewhat eccentric. A lot of people here locally have tried to reach out to him. Not that he's holed up like a, you know, like a John Hughes character someplace. But, you know, John, are you okay? I'm sure he's doing fine, but he probably doesn't need to work. And it seemed like he was championing his son's career more than his own there for a number of years. The last thing that he did here that I was aware of, he actually rewrote a script called The Visitors, which actually was a huge European box office success, and adapted
right.
it for an American audience, which became Just Visiting.
I remember
yes.
that. Yeah.
Yes.
And man, the film tanked. It really did not do so well.
What is the exact kind of film as the French one, just with in English? And,
right.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I couldn't get over.
In fact, Jean Renault, it was a lot of the same actors.
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
In fact, it was the same director. Hughes rewrote the script. I think he had maybe was going to be part producer, but I think his love affair with some of the politics of filmmaking is long gone. I think he feels like
right.
something he's just not interested in. And then the last thing, I think Made in Manhattan.
Yes.
Was a script that he wrote, which I believe he was going to direct. In fact, he was going to direct it here in Chicago. At the time, it was called Chambermaid, and then it was changed to Made in Manhattan, and then it was Made in Manhattan, or at least made to look like it was Made in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, John was he was a machine. He was cranking out movies that he was directing or producing or furthering the careers of people like Chris Columbus and the Home Alone
yeah.
series, and
yeah.
and he was like a one man band, and frankly, while there were some other folks doing it at the time as well, directors like Andy Davis and Michael Mann, John was very much put Chicago's North Shore on everybody's map. I mean, it became like the place of an entire generation, and with the fascination people have for movies like Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Breakfast Club and 16 mm-hmm. Candles. He really did Chicago a great service. And the fact that he's somewhat eccentric, I think, just makes it that much more interesting.
It does, doesn't it? And he's like the J.D. Salinger of filmmaking.
Exactly.
There's a lot of truth to that. I mean, there really is.
And for a guy like me in a show like this, I mean, he is... I mean, people ask me, who's the brass ring? And, I mean, my personal idol is Al Pacino. But really, the brass ring is John Hughes, because we haven't heard from him.
Right.
And who knows?
So maybe
long.
He'll... We, our office produces what is an outdoor Film Festival here in Chicago, which actually is a huge event. It draws like 30, sometimes almost 40,000 people out in Grant Park to watch.
That's incredible. That's
it
a
really
great
is.
Turnout.
And it shows American classics for the most part. And last year, I believe it was, or maybe it was the year before, we started, instead of just concentrating on movies from the 30s and 40s and 50s, we started moving up in the decades and actually showed Ferris Bueller's Day Off. And invited John to come and, you know, do whatever he wanted to do. He could just hang out quietly and watch the movie.
Right.
Or he could say something or kind of left it open. I wrote what I thought was a rather impassioned letter in the hopes of getting him to come downtown, but to no avail, which was cool.
Wow.
But
wow.
Yeah, I think part of his attractiveness just seems to grow the less people know about him these days. And
I guess that's true. Yeah.
And he certainly was never one, to my understanding anyway. He was never one to enjoy a lot of press or publicity.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't enjoy the sort of politics and the gymnastics of dealing with studio and budgets and things like that. I think he really just loved making films and telling his stories and working with actors, and obviously there's more to it than that. And I think after a while he probably felt like, I don't have to do this.
It happens. I mean,
yeah, I've always been interested, though, because I personally like his adult films as well. I love Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Oh, yeah.
That. But in terms of, you know, where he made his mark, like you mentioned, 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, that kind of thing, always fascinated to know what he thinks of the youth of today and how it's changed, and if he would have if he could write something like the, a Breakfast Club again. I mean, it almost seems very innocent, his films now.
You're right. And to look at them, too, I mean, just the sort of fresh faces of you know, the players that he used almost was like an ensemble. I mean, it does seem a little sweet.
Yeah, bittersweet. Mr. Moskal, this has been a fascinating, fantastic conversation. I've enjoyed having you on so much.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
No, thank you for coming on.
Anytime you want, just stop back by. We'd love to continue the conversation for a long time to come.
Well, I hope you can resurrect that part 2 and 3 of George Reinhold.
I'm going to. We're going to air it tomorrow. I'm going to get to the bottom of it. I'm going to take care of that. Thank you for saving us.
Thank you.
Hey, Melissa,
thank you very much.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Thank you, sir. Have a good evening.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That is Rich Moskal. He is the director of the Chicago Film Office. Really good conversation. I enjoyed that a lot.
That was great. There's a lot, I mean, to ask him. I mean, there's so much. But no, it's great, and he's so enthusiastic. And I know what he's saying, like, you know, about the whole Chicago, the movie Chicago. And, like, down here we have Baltimore takes the place of D.C. a lot of the time. I don't know why, but it just does. Like, for Die Hard 4, they came out, they shot that in Baltimore instead of in the district. So it happens here, too.
Yeah, I suppose it does. Was I very subtle in trying to nab John Hughes?
No. It would.
I was trying to test the waters, like if he had a relationship with Mr. Hughes. Hey, could you put in a good word? Apparently, I mean, he doesn't come out for anyone.
He doesn't come out. Hughes is. I would like to say something about him. Like his films, I liked them in high school, but I think they take on even a deeper meaning as you get older, especially when you're removed from that. I actually feel Breakfast Club means more to me now than it did when I first saw it, because I was in high school, not one of the greatest experiences, you know, of most people's lives. So you want to distance yourself, but you watch it. I say, like, when I watched it when I was 30, I was like, you know, it's a very, you know, profound film. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, he's a real filmmaker, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and he made films that that had a brain.
They did.
You know, and you didn't necessarily recognize that when you were, you know, 12 or 13 watching
mm-hmm.
them. But you're right. Absolutely. Aaron.
What's up, guys?
What's
hey,
up?
Buddy. You know, your line has been live this whole time.
I didn't know that.
You have been so silent.
Yeah.
I wish I'd known that, because I wanted to ask about my question would have been, what was it like to get Michael Mann back to Chicago, because Thief was one of the great showcases for Chicago. Granted, did not show the Chicago police in the best light, but that's one of the great Chicago films from, like, 1981.
Thief
is
I one agree.
Of those great film. And now that, you know, Michael Mann, it's kind of, he's come full circle. He's, you know, Thief was shot, you know, kind of run and gun, and, you know, he got all he wanted, but, you know, he had to make do with the budget. But now he's come back, and he got probably the biggest budget, you know, probably one of his biggest budgets. And
that's true.
Going
I can't
still.
Wait. Michael Mann is up there with Lynch for me in terms of just one of our great atmospheric directors.
And I can't.
And Chicago is a great place for atmosphere. I mean, just look at the Dark Knight of it.
Yeah.
And I'm excited that I just looked online that Public Enemy is going to be the 4th of July release of 2009.
Wow.
4th of July. Wow. Okay.
It's a summer movie. A summer Michael Mann.
I had no idea it was a summer movie.
It
okay.
Said, July 1st,
I'm surprised. Does Will Smith have a cameo by chance?
Hey, man.
Will Smith.
Mr. 4th of July.
Him and Michael Mann might be a team. The other film I would have liked, I mean, speaking of, you know, Public Enemy, I would have liked, what is the Public Enemy shoot compare to the Untouchables shoot? Because, you know, 20 years ago, which covers similar ground and I'm sure had similar logistical.
Oh yeah, I'm sure of it.
Probably because we all know that De Palma is not a stickler for detail.
But Michael Mann certainly is.
Oh, definitely.
It doesn't surprise me one bit that he turned to the real thing, because if anything's into authenticity, if anyone is, it would be Michael Mann.
I heard that he dug up John Dillinger to make a cameo, just for reference.
That's terrible. That's terrible. Okay, we've got some DVDs to discuss, my friend.
Yes, we do.
Let me say right at the top here, I'm very sorry about Judge Reinhold. We played the first 20 minutes of the conversation. We had another 20 minutes. What I'm going to do is I'm going to make three separate shows, so anyone listening can catch what they missed to the show. So, Aaron, you and I and Jerry will have our own show. And
okay.
Mr. Mosca will have his own show. And Mr. Reinhold, the corrected interview, will have his own show. So, just look for that on the archive tomorrow. We'll all be stars of our own shows.
This could be like some of those DVD packages, the lost interviews.
There you go.
Yeah. I'm just like Dick Cavett, right? Okay, DVDs, Criterion Collection. I mean, the godfather of all DVD companies. I mean, they keep doing bang-up jobs with every title they come out with, and we're going to spotlight two this evening that are both available in stores now, correct?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yes, they are.
Why don't you go first? What's your title?
Mine is Akira Kurosawa's High and Low from 1965. So it's one of his later films, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone always called Kurosawa the most Western of Japanese filmmakers. And here he sort of seems to embrace that, in that this is a adaptation of the American story King's Ransom, the American novel King's Ransom, obviously, of the but Kurosawa obviously brings his own style to it. It's a story about class. And here it's the son of a chauffeur of a wealthy man is kidnapped by mistake when they thought they were kidnapping the wealthy man's son.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And so the chauffeur goes to the man to pay the ransom, and of course this disrupts the class hierarchy, and it causes a lot of emotional and just a lot of suspense. I mean, it starts off as a very very quiet chamber piece almost with just the character development. And then once this kidnapping takes over, it turned into a real, truly terrific suspense story. And
mm-hmm.
Kurosawa's, you know, it's a, if I remember correctly, the running time is 2 hours and 25 minutes. I mean, so it's one of the, you know, it really luxuriates in the story, but it does, there's no fat on it, and it really gets it going, and it's got a terrific central performance by Toshiro Mifune. That's just terrific. And of course,
I'm a rabid Kurosawa fan, actually.
Right.
When I started to watch foreign films, and I'm ashamed to say it, I didn't start until a few years ago. I said, man, I really need to expand my, you know, I've got all this junk, you know, American film knowledge. I know nothing about foreign films. I started with Kurosawa, and I started with The Seven Samurai, which is a great place to start because I was addicted right away. And,
that's a great one. This is an awesome one, too.
Yeah, watched a lot of his films, but I have not yet seen High and Low, so
I'm
anxious to purchase this.
Couple of questions for Aaron.
Yeah.
First of all, what's new on this edition? Because I have the edition of this film before the older edition. What's different?
One is the, it's the two-disc one, and so the commentary is by Stephen Prince, another
mm-hmm.
very erudite commentary that we come to expect from Criterion. And then the second disc is has another excerpt in the series of Kurosawa filmmaking series from the Toho Film Project.
Right.
Toho, yeah.
Yeah, and so it chronicles the making of High and Low, and that's really the centerpiece of this, and also the booklet that has the essay, detailed critical breakdown of the film.
Who is the essay by?
It
wouldn't be by any chance Michael Jack, would it? Because he's
it is not Michael Jack.
Okay, because he's a very, I know him. He's a very nice guy. He just knows everything there is to know about Japanese cinema. He raved about this film a lot when I first met him.
Well, the interesting thing about it is that Criterion is a stickler for authenticity, but it comes with both. It comes with a four-track stereo mix that is quite good. You expect that from them, but it's a very well done audio mix, and
yeah.
it's just really, really well. Oh, the essay is by Jeffrey O'Brien.
Okay, all right.
Jeffrey O'Brien,
okay.
Writer.
Okay.
And it also has a new interview with actor Tsutomu Yamazaki, who played the kidnapper.
Okay.
And that's very good. So,
you know, it goes without saying that any Criterion title we recommend. So we don't even have to give service to that.
Well, what's interesting? What's interesting about this, real quick before we get on to the vampire, is that, you know, Criterion, they're not double dippers.
Right.
They really aren't.
No, not
and
at
so,
all.
You know, High and Low was, if I remember correctly, was released just as a disc, as a film, you know, with a good transfer and not much else. So when they do upgrade, like they've upgraded The Third Man and a couple other titles, you know, they really make it worth the upgrade.
Yeah,
That should be noted that High and Low is worthy of the upgrade.
You know, and you mentioned what's the film you just mentioned, The Third Man. Is that out? When does that get released?
Well, that has been out. The two-disc upgrade has been out.
That's been out for a while.
A year ago. But also make note that it is going to be in probably the first or second wave of Blu-ray criterions.
Wow.
So that should be exciting.
I'll just wait to get it on Blu-ray again. So
yeah,
absolutely. That's a great film.
That's an awesome film.
And let me just say, too, that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to get into Kurosawa if it wasn't for the Criterion Collection. Out of all the filmmakers they profile, they seem to have a particular affinity for Kurosawa. I mean, they really do represent his titles very well. So I thank them for that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Some of these films I would never have seen if it wasn't for them.
And we talk about, Aaron, I know you and I have spoken about it a lot, the Laserdisc revolution, you know, mm-hmm. as muted as it was, but it was loud and clear in our lives, and how it, you know, how we'd be so excited to pick up all these Laserdiscs, and part of the thrill of it was the packaging.
Yeah.
And that's something that I've missed from DVDs, and Criterion still excels at it in DVD, just as they did with Laserdisc. And a prime example of that is the one I'm holding in my hand now, Vampire. A gorgeous-looking box, just so aesthetically pleasing, and a very interesting film and an important film in history with a beautiful transfer. This is the Dreyer film. It's basically his horror genre film, and it's an interesting watch, but you know, what's most illuminating are the extras, as usual. We have, just like you said earlier, one of those terrific academic commentaries during the film. I don't speak this language. I can't pronounce the name. Jorgen Roos, I think it is. And it's very informative. No. That's the documentary that was made of Dreyer. Marlon Kerber. Let me see. Tony Raines. Tony Raines did the commentary. He's a film scholar, and it's very informative about Dreyer's career and the placement that Vampire plays in his career. And the Jorgen Roos is actually a documentary. He directed a documentary chronicling Dreyer's career that's included in this in the supplemental package here. And it's fantastic. You hear other directors and filmmakers talk about Dreyer's work, and then you hear from Dreyer himself. This is a 1966 documentary.
Cool.
It's got it's the transfer is just pristine. I mean, this is a 1932 film, so it's had some wear and tear, and I'm sure they had their work cut out for them when they embarked on this job. But it's beautiful transfer.
It's interesting to note that a friend to both of our shows, Glenn Kinney, wrote on his blog an illuminating history of his of his an illuminating piece on his history with the film and
mm-hmm.
How many times he's seen it theatrically, in that he's always had to see it on very scratchy, worn, you know, mis-subtitled or wrong subtitled Prince of Vampire, and that
right.
This Criterion edition was really the first time he really quote unquote saw the movie. And so
mm-hmm.
From what I've read of reviews of this DVD that's been coming out, Advanced Reviews, Dave Kerr, and others who have talked, is that this Mike Clark in USA Today, that this is really the best that Vampire has ever looked.
Without a question, I'm certain of it. And it's a very accomplished visual movie in terms of the lighting and his use of shadows and.
Well, that's the thing about Dreyer. I mean, he's one of those directors you can debate on whether or not. There is a discussion to be had on whether, you know, his visual style kind of overwhelms any kind of emotional
right.
content, because
mm-hmm.
there's people who say he's very emotional and it's very disturbing, and there's those who say they love his visuals but find him kind of cold and detached, which is not a detraction against him, but that it takes multiple viewings to really get into his film. I guess you could say Dreyer is the German precursor to Stanley Kubrick. If you want to comparing directors. Go ahead.
The icing on the cake in this set, just so I can get this in. It's got a very attractive and informative booklet included, featuring essays on the film and on Dreyer, and on the restoration itself. And it also comes with a book that contains the original screenplay and the story on which it's based, which is called Carmilla, and it's a very interesting read. I've gone through most of it. The book itself is called Writing Vampire, and so in any kind of thorough understanding that you want to glean from Vampyr. I mean, it's all here in this beautiful package. I
whenever
mean, no stone unturned.
Whenever Criterion decides to throw in, and I'm not talking about a booklet. I mean, when they actually decide to make a book a part of the packaging, I know it's expensive, but it's really it pays off in the long run. I treasure my Shortcuts DVD Criterion.
The Carver, yeah.
All the Carver stories, which is, I mean, to me, that is the best extra on that two-disc set, which is just one of the best ones they've ever done. But the fact that they were able to, they took the plunge and decided to collect all those Carver stories into one thing was a masterstroke.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple of questions. We had a question in the chat room about Dark City. I understand that's being remastered on DVD and re-released with extras in a two-disc collection. Do you know anything about that?
It came out, I believe, if I remember correctly, it came out yesterday on Blu-ray.
Okay.
And it's Proyas's director's cut. He went back and instated, I think it's 10, 11 minutes that he took out. And according to Proyas, I did not receive a copy of it. But according to Alex Proyas, he says that it changes the tone and the meaning of the film quite profoundly. So I am quite intrigued. Ebert did do a commentary. Apparently this was a couple of years in the making. I remember Ebert did do a commentary back in 06 because he wrote about this version in his Great Movies section. So
it was his favorite movie of
that year, of 98. Mm-hmm. It was the best film of 98. And it really is a truly great visual experience, and so it's on Blu-ray. It has been, this director's cut has been released on regular DVD. But if you're any of our listeners are into the Blu-ray yet, that's the way to go with Dark City.
And it looks like September is a excuse me, a great month for DVDs, especially. I mean, we have some dynamite titles. We spoke to John Hughes about John Hughes earlier. He's got a few of his titles out on the special edition DVDs in September,
yeah,
isn't it?
His first three directorial efforts will be coming out in special editions. That's 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, and Weird Science. The Breakfast Club, I'm most intrigued about because it'll have a Anthony Michael Hall, Judd Nelson commentary.
Yeah.
I'm actually kind of excited about that's the one I'm really excited about. That's in September. September 2nd is Bright Lights Big City, 20th Anniversary Edition. I'm really excited about that. September 9th is the 20th Anniversary of edition of Child's Play. And, of course, the mother load of DVD restorations coming out in September is the Godfather Trilogy restoration, coming out on standard definition DVD, but more impressively on Blu-ray. And that's probably the collection I'm most excited about.
Yeah, I think we all are. I think that goes without saying.
Hopefully, I'm sure that'll turn out just to be gangbusters, as Jamie likes to say.
Yeah, Jamie, I've been criticized for that.
Jamie, you real quick, one more thing on Vampyr. You were telling me earlier that you thought the cover of the Vampyr DVD was probably the best thing you'd seen, that you were hoping there was a poster of that.
No. Another Criterion DVD, M.
Okay. Oh,
which
M,
is
M,
my,
M.
Yeah, which is my favorite classic film, actually.
Okay.
I mean, it's
okay.
Up there. It's up there with Citizen Kane for me.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, M is like one of those films. Yeah. I mean,
in
no
terms
doubt.
Of innovation, in terms of innovation too, and it came almost 10 years prior to Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they had my God, what's going on with my throat tonight? And the beautiful cover image, and I cannot find a replication of that on a poster. I would kill to have that in my living room.
Well, if anyone's listening, or anyone who is going to listen later on, who's anyway connected to Criterion, please email me or Jamie and let us know if that's a poster image or a frame taken from the film, and if we can get a replication.
Absolutely, hook me up, guys. Come on. There's a guest here, and he's a big horror fanatic, and he says next year we're looking at the 35th anniversary of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Let me just say, guest, whoever you might be, Texas Chainsaw is a movie that actually kind of changed my life. It is the the scariest movie I've ever seen in my life. I still shake every time I put it in the DVD player. I saw it like 20 years ago when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
But I always thought it was funny in one of those initial special editions, Devil Josh. I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry, man. In one of those special editions, it had a quote from Tobe Hooper that said, "The last time this movie looked this good," he was speaking of The Transfer, "was when I was looking at it through the viewfinder." I don't know. I don't know how many people have actually shot a movie. Movies don't look great in the viewfinder, especially like the mono camera that they were probably using back in 74. I thought that was a funny quote.
Wear thick glasses, so you know, I don't know if you can take him at his word.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so does that mean we're going to get another special edition of Texas Chainsaw Massacre next year? Maybe we'll get the Blu-ray edition.
Yeah, this actually comes with a chainsaw. They're really going way out. Yeah,
it comes with a chainsaw.
It comes with a chainsaw and a severed head. It's amazing.
And
takes up a lot of shelf space.
And a recipe for chili.
And a recipe for chili.
We should be the brainstormers for these special edition DVDs. That's terrific. All right, it's been another great Flying by the Seat of Our Pants show. We thank everyone out there for joining us. Look at our archives, because we're going to have the complete Judge Reinhold interview, I promise, along with all of our other great conversations archived from tonight in their own separate shows sometime tomorrow. In the meantime, I'll leave this one up for anyone who wants to access it in the next 24 hours. Thank you all so much for joining us, Aaron, Jerry.
Yeah.
Thanks. It's been great fun. And we'll see you guys Sunday.
All right.
Sunday. Aaron, I want to say, your show is going fantastically well. It's called Back by Midnight. It's on Blog Talk Radio. For anyone that's interested in checking it out, it's blogtalkradio.com/back. By midnight, separated by slashes, so /by-midnight, GHT.
Yes, it's going very well. If anyone's interested, last night I had a 30-minute interview with director John Badham in conjunction with the release of the 25th anniversary edition DVD of War Games.
Tell them what's coming up on the 14th.
This is really exciting. August 14th will be a tribute show, roundtable discussion, of the DVD, recent DVD release of the John Sayles coming of age bittersweet classic Baby It's You from 1983, and that has finally been put out on home format. I think it was there the VHS, but there was never a Laserdisc, and finally it's out on DVD. And I will be having a roundtable discussion with director John Sayles, writer and co-producer Amy Robinson, and the two lead actors from the film, Rosanna Arquette and Vincent Spano.
Yeah,
wow, okay, cool.
Dedicated to the movie Baby It's You. Hopefully with this show people will go out and buy that film, because it truly, next to, it ranks with The Wanderers as one of my favorite coming-of-age stories.
Yeah.
The Wanderers, so it'd make a great double bill with The Wanderers.
You know what my favorite coming-of-age movie is? I was reminded of it just last night when I rewatched it, 9 1/2 weeks. Because when I saw 9 1/2 weeks as a teenager, I really felt like I came of age.
I'm sure a lot of
my life has been downhill since.
Oh my! You know, no one can hear us now. You know that, right?
That's why I'm saying what I'm saying.
I know. Okay.
All right, guys.
All right.
I'll talk to you guys later.
Coming of age. Right.
Thanks for joining us, guys.
All
we'll
right.
talk to you later. Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.